Spirit Radio Podcasts.
It's hard to believe, but it's been 10 years since conflict broke out in Syria back in 2011, and Tear Fund Ireland continues to work with the most vulnerable Syrian refugees. On the line to tell us a little bit more and also to give us the latest news from Yemen, which is still considered the worst humanitarian crisis in the world, we've Niamh Daly, Communications Manager at Tear Fund Ireland. Morning to you, Niamh. How are you?
Good morning, Wendy. Very well, thank you.
Well, first of all, you're going to start off just by giving us an update on the current situation for Lebanon and specifically for refugees. And of course, we're all trying to manage this lockdown, but it's hard to imagine what it must be like for a person living in Lebanon, living as a refugee and in lockdown.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And I think particularly with all that's gone on for Lebanon in the last 12 months, you know, so, you know, in those 10 years, they're estimating nearly 7 million people have come out of Syria. And a lot of those are in neighbouring countries like Lebanon. And so Lebanon is, you know, a series of crises. There's a lot of political unrest. Generally, then an economic crisis and coronavirus, and then we had that blast in the port in Beirut then in August, you know, so it's compounded. Now, initially, their response to COVID had been very good and their infection rates were under control. But similar to ourselves, really, they did open up just before Christmas, really in an attempt to inject some hope into their crumbling economy. But figures have really spiraled, and a lockdown that they put in place on the 7th of January failed. So last Thursday, they have got into a full lockdown where even residents aren't able to do their grocery shopping and they're dependent on food deliveries. And now our concern really around this is that the people who can access delivery online is, you know, minimal really, and the poorest of poor in Lebanon, who really are the refugees from Syria, and would not have access online. And, you know, deliveries, you know, the capacity of supermarkets to deliver into makeshift tents and accommodation is minimal, you know, and these were people who wouldn't have had the cash reserves to afford to buy enough food to get them through these supermarket closures when they heard. So we're very, very concerned about the situation in Lebanon and our work with refugees there.
And how has your work been affected? I mean, with that lockdown that's so severe, and Niamh, is any humanitarian help able to reach some of these people?
Well, there was daily there was weekly distributions of food packages, but there's serious restrictions now on those. Now, some of our centres are very close to where the refugees are living, so, you know, it may be possible to do something there. But when our team spoke with Lebanon last week, you know, they were in a real crisis mode trying to manage these new announcements and how they were going to reach the people they've been supporting.
It's a situation that's hard to imagine, and I guess puts in perspective, you know, how difficult we might be finding it. But to add on all of those things, what about the vaccine situation for Lebanon, Niamh?
Yeah, and I suppose maybe it's just good, you know, to look at, you know, comparison. So their government have ordered enough of the Pfizer BioNTech vaccine, but it won't reach them until mid-February. They just wouldn't have the strength in terms of economy or whatever to command, like a country like Ireland has. And they've ordered enough to cover 15% of the population, you know. The vaccine isn't the great hope for Lebanon that it is for countries like Ireland and the rest of Europe.
It shows the real disparity between nations that are impoverished and wealthy nations. And it does really make you think that perhaps, that, you know, the wealthier nations who can order this vaccine should be supporting those who don't have the financial firepower to be able to vaccinate more of their population.
That's it. And we're really, you know, we're just sweeping a problem under the carpet by not acknowledging that this vaccine needs to really be given out on equal terms across the world, you know.
And that's the thing, the fact that it's happening on unequal terms is not right, you know, and I think many people would agree with that. Talk to me a little bit, Niamh, about the situation in Yemen at the moment.
Yemen, so, you know, I've spoken about this before. I mean, it's just under the radar because there's so little media access into that country. But the UN, you know, reckon that some 80% of the population require humanitarian assistance, and there's a real lack of water, safe water, in Yemen, and so, you know, it's a real, real problem. So really, because of the support of Irish supporters for Tear Fund and churches, we were able to start a program there. We've done different things over time. We responded to a cholera outbreak some years ago, but particularly with COVID, we were able to ring fence some funds for Yemen. And for 3 months, we've been able to support 100 households who've been designated as needing support because they are female-headed. There may be the mum might be pregnant and are lactating, and they also had somebody in the household who had documented evidence of malnutrition. So this would be, you know, a formal health centre would have, you know, diagnosed somebody in the house as having malnutrition. So these really are the poorest of poor. 100 households were identified, and through training we were able to, you know, raise awareness around cholera and coronavirus, and then provide weekly food packs as well. And, you know, it just seems so small to what we can do, but we were delighted there recently to hear that funds have continued to come in, and we can continue to extend that program into Yemen and continue to support those households into 2021 anyway.
Yeah, which is good news. And finally, Niamh, you have an update for us on the situation in Ethiopia. I know that Tear Fund does a lot with self-help groups. You might start off by just explaining to us again how these groups work and the impact they have.
Yeah, so we support about 700 self-help groups in southern Ethiopia, and they're facilitated by the local church and overseen by, we have staff in an office there in Addis. And by saving together and pooling the resources and sharing the advice, these self-help groups offer members loans then that enable them to set up small enterprise. So women like Mbawish there, so she had a large family, really was in the grip of poverty, but through saving and the emotional and, you know, advice as well from these groups and the support of all of that around her, she was able to start up a small business by her house, a little hut that sold vegetables, spices and flowers. But since lockdown, the demand for her goods and services dried up overnight because most of her customers were day labourers, and with lockdowns, they just disappeared, and just wasn't there the demand for her produce. So her stock has just, you know, normally she'd have to replenish it weekly. It's now lying there unsold for months. So what we've been able to do is we've been able to raise funds through working together actually with other Irish NGOs to give a cash, an emergency cash injection into self-help groups like Bayouish's. So she'll be able to access a loan, you know, per person. It'll probably be around €30, and that will help her buy essentials for her family during this corona outbreak. So we're really grateful to be able to do that. It's unusual for us to do something like that. Normally it's really just the resources of the self-help groups themselves, but with the challenges around the pandemic and just the real poverty that people are falling into in a much deeper way, we've been able to do this.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that one of the brilliant things about the self-help groups is it is what it says in the tin, is trying to make sure that these people can get themselves out of poverty, but unprecedented times, and that the fact that you can give that extra support is wonderful. Niamh, I would imagine, like most charities at the moment, it's difficult to fundraise. So many things you had planned can't happen. How can people support your work at this time?
That's great. Well, if, you know, I mean, obviously there's lots of challenges here in Ireland, and people have lost their jobs and, you know, are in their own challenges here. So that's not where we're looking for funds. But if you found yourself in a position where you didn't have the holiday you were planning, or the upgrade of the car, and you can support our work, you know, we can make every euro count, and it really does go to those who need it most. So you can go online to tearfund.ie and support our work online. That would be wonderful.
Niamh, as always, thank you so much for that update and for the work that Tear Fund does. If you want to find out more information about the work Tear Fund does, or indeed support their work, you can go to tearfund.ie. Spirit. Do you know, I think no matter if you're a confident person or if you've done loads of interviews, it's always nerve-wracking. You're always going to get those butterflies. But what about doing a job interview during a pandemic when it's carried out over something like Zoom? When, you know, you might feel you might be able to get that connection with the person that's interviewing you. So how can you best manage doing one of these online interviews? Well, my next guest has coached thousands of people in preparing for interviews in her job as a career consultant with Hilt in Limerick. And she's also written a book called CV and Interview 101. It's great to have Sinead English with me on the line. Sinead, morning to you.
Morning, Wendy.
So tell us a little bit about or what you know, or have you had a lot of people getting in touch with you, Sinead, about having to do Zoom interviews now during the pandemic?
Absolutely. It's whether it's Zoom or Teams or WebEx or whatever platform the employer wants to use. Just about every candidate now that we are coaching for interview training is doing the interviews via one of these platforms.
And what are the big differences then between doing a face-to-face interview and an online interview then?
Well, you know what? I mean, what you actually say to them is the same, whether you're looking across the table from them in a real setting or whether you are looking at a screen. But there are a number of things that you need to do in advance of a Zoom or a video interview, which you don't really have to consider when you're doing a face-to-face interview. So just thinking about it just before I came on here, I mean, I've got five main points that people need to consider before they ever open their mouth and start talking in the interview. So
okay.
I thought I'd maybe just go through them and people can kind of tick them off one after another, because it is anxious. And most of the anxiety that comes from candidates when they're doing one of these interviews is not so much, oh, what am I going to say? Is the tech going to work? And what happens if it drops? And what happens if somebody walks into the room while I'm doing the interview? So the first five things that you should try and fix, and these are all within your control, is number one, your broadband connection. So test it out beforehand. If you know that your house or where you're going to be doing the interview from has a habit of the broadband, the Wi-Fi just dropping every now and then, it's not a good idea to do it from there, because the whole way through the interview, you'll be worried about, am I going to get to the end of it without the connection dropping? So fix that. Do a line test. And if it's just really, really bad, maybe you could go on 4G. Maybe you could go somewhere else within your 5K where you could get a better signal.
Yeah, that's or sometimes thing. In our house, Sinead, what we have to do is, because we don't have great internet, is everybody else has to turn off their Wi-Fi, and then it makes the Wi-Fi stronger. But test beforehand seems to be the advice.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think everybody now in every house in the country, family WhatsApp groups, and the number one message is get off the Wi-Fi. I'm about to do an interview or I'm about to do something. So number one, test it. And test it at the time that you're doing the interview. The Wi-Fi could be fantastic at 9 in the morning. It could be terrible at 4 in the afternoon. So test it at the time you're doing it. So that's the first thing. Broadband connection, Wi-Fi. Second thing is your background. So depending on the platform that you're using, you might be able to blur the background. You could put on a virtual background. And if you can't do any of those things, then make sure that the background that they're seeing is a tidy background. Now, it doesn't have to be pristine. Some people go to great lengths to put bookcases behind them with very knowledgeable...
Yes, they have a cultivated book collection that you wonder if they've ever been opened.
Exactly. You don't need to do any of that stuff. Just make sure it's clean and tidy. We did an interview once with somebody. It was a video interview, which was pre-recorded. And this candidate did the interview in front of an open fridge. So the fridge was open behind them.
Oh,
it was a bizarre thing. All I was doing was trying to see what they had in the fridge. Like, it was crazy.
I know, I'm getting hungry rather than listening to the interview.
Yeah.
Okay, so think of your background, very important.
Think of your background. If you can blur it, great. If you can put on a virtual background. You know, don't try to be too clever about the virtual background. Just something fairly plain, it's fine. So that's the second thing. The third thing is the lighting and the position of the camera. So we have seen some candidates do interviews on video where the light source is right over their head. So they're in a room with a pendant light, you know, shining on them, and they look like some sort of ghost because all the shadows are coming down on top of their face. Similarly, if you're in a room where the light is to the side of you, one side of you will be lit up and the other side of you will be in shadows.
Okay, and you just look strange. And again, it's really distracting.
It's really distracting. And, you know, they talk about making eye contact in these interviews. If I can't see your face, well, that's the first disadvantage. So sit in front of the light source, whether that's in front of a window, if it's during the day, or set up a lamp and put that in front of you and just try it out. I mean, you can go on, you take a photo of yourself on your laptop or go on FaceTime or one of those apps that you can actually see yourself before the look call goes on to make sure that the lighting is right. So check the lighting. Now, remember, you haven't even said anything to them yet and you're doing all this stuff in advance, but it is going to stand to you when you actually start the interview.
Yeah,
so check the lighting and the position of the camera. That's the other thing. Prop up the camera or your laptop so that the camera is at your eye level.
And that's one thing that I think people find difficult as well, just in terms of where the camera's at, Sinead, because, you know, are you meant to look down straight into the camera lens, but then that's hard because you're not actually looking at the person and it's hard to connect with them then.
Yeah, exactly. So my next point is, my number four is, look at the camera. Your temptation is to look at the screen, right? Because all the action is there, the person that's interviewing is there. And you know, if it's a panel interview, you could have three or four interviewers, all their pictures on the boxes on your laptop. But you need to be looking at the camera, because when you're looking at the camera, what they see is you looking at them. They see you making eye contact with them. And as hard as it is to not keep straining your eyes down to see, oh, how am I looking on the camera, or how's who's everybody else there, you need to be looking at the camera for most of the time. So one tip that we give our clients is to just get a post-it note, a little sticky note, put a smiley face on it and stick it right beside the camera and say, look here. It just reminds you to keep looking up there.
Yeah, very good advice.
Keep looking up there. And then the fifth one is to do a trial run. So you've never used Teams before and the interview is on Teams. Well, do a trial run with a friend of yours doing a Teams call. So to make sure that you're logged into the right platform, the worst thing you want to be doing is struggling to connect with the call because you don't know how to minimize pop-ups, or you don't know how to give your laptop access to your camera. That is major stress when you know that there's an interviewer waiting on the other side for you to get your act together.
What about, Sinead, making an impression? Because, you know, one of the things I always remember in advance of an interview is that whole thing of the impression that's made in the first few seconds, and things like having a good handshake and all that sort of stuff. But in the absence of that physical contact, how can you make a good impression?
Well, again, it's about being prepared. So when the camera comes on you, that you're not looking down on the ground, or you're not struggling to figure out which way up the camera is, or that you're not halfway sitting down, like that you're ready to go. As soon as that camera comes on, you're ready to go. You look at the camera and you say, hi, good morning, nice to meet you.
Yeah, and you're ready to go and you're kind of confident.
Exactly.
Is there any other things, you know, just general tips for people to take on board, Sinead, especially kind of around nerves and things that they can prepare in advance? Obviously, it depends on the type of industry and stuff, but in just kind of general tips of those kind of regular questions that are asked, you know, what's your biggest flaw and where do you see yourself in 5 years? Are they still kind of common enough questions?
Not so much. They're pretty uninspired questions. I think if they're asking about your flaw, they're more likely to phrase it, what's your area for improvement? So you could mention that you've got, say, knowledge in two software packages, but this third one that you know they use a little bit in that company, you need to get up to speed on that. So you're not going to say, I'm absolutely useless at organising myself or something, because that would not be a good plan.
What about people when their nerves kind of have an impact on their memory? Like, should you use notes to kind of remind you of things you want to mention during the interview? Or is it better just to keep looking at the camera and go with what's in your head at the time?
Well, yeah, that's a great question, Wendy, because, of course, the temptation is, I'm at home, they can't see me. They can't see what I have on my desk, so I'll have all the notes for every question that I think they're going to ask, and then as soon as they ask it, I'll look over at my notes. Well, they can see you looking at the notes. So it's very important not to do that. You really should not be having a whole pile of notes in front of you on your desk. But what you can do, and you know what, when we're working with clients on interview training, and we certainly go through this a lot in the book, is you can predict about 90% of the questions that they will ask in an interview by just looking at the job description. So when the job description says that we need people who can work under pressure and who have experience in client onboarding and who can work in teams and who can solve problems, you know, or it's very likely that the questions they're going to ask you are all going to be related to those particular things in the job spec. So if they ask you in an interview for a job where the job spec is talking about solving problems all the time, if they say, tell me about a problem you faced and how you solved it, you should not be surprised to be asked that question.
Yeah, so you can predict the questions, yeah.
Yeah. If you're struggling to answer that, if I was interviewing you, I would go, okay, this was all over the job spec and they can't even give me an example. So it's about giving them evidence. So look at the job spec, highlight the things they're looking for, and then have an example that you can give them of where you demonstrated that.
A final question for you, Sinead. So you've done all that and taken that advice and prepped with the job spec and prepped your answers and prepared. But what happens if you get asked a question that you don't know the answer to? You're stumped, basically, or that you're struggling to answer. Do you try and wing it? Do you try and fluff it? Or do you just hold your hands up and say, I don't know?
Well, it depends on the type of question. So if the question is, why should we give you this role? And you can't answer it. Well, then, you know, I think it's not really going to go very well. I mean, they would expect you to be able to answer that, or tell me about yourself. So those really obvious questions, if you can't answer them, I think it's not going to end well for you. However, if it's a question like, what do you know about the EU directive on...
A complicated technical question, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. On post-it notes. I've got some post-it notes here on my desk. So the EU directive on the latest post-it notes... conflict or whatever, and you're thinking to yourself, I have no idea, like I have no clue. So what you can do there, you have a couple of options. You can say, I don't know. You could sit there with your, just staring at the camera, waiting for them to take you out of your misery, or you could take control of it and say, try and make a slight joke about it by saying something like, well, you know, I've done a lot of research for this interview today, unfortunately. The EU directive on post-it notes was not part of my research, but I guarantee you, as soon as I finish this interview, I'll be looking it up.
Yeah, very good advice, Sinead. Very good advice indeed. Thanks so much for joining us on the programme today. That's Sinead English. She's a career consultant and author of CV and Interview 101. If you want to get in touch with her, and there's lots of really good blogs and articles on their website, which is wearehilt.com. Spirit. So our next guest is a singer-songwriter who's been making waves across international Christian radio since the launch of his debut single last year. Spirit Radio's Victoria Johnston caught up with Cade Thompson about how his faith has supported him as a musician through the pandemic and just the role that faith has played in his songwriting. And this is the chat that they had. The first thing that Victoria chatted to him about was what inspired his song Every Step of the Way.
My name's Cade, I'm 19 years old. And I wrote this song Every Step of the Way as I was kind of transitioning into a new season in my life. At the time, I had just graduated high school. I was about to move to Nashville, Tennessee. I'd actually just got an apartment down here. At the point in time, I didn't have a record deal. I just was saying, Lord, I'm going to trust you with what's ahead. And I wrote this song kind of just as a declaration over my life of, Lord, I don't know what's ahead, but I've seen your faithfulness in the past scenes that the past seasons of my life, even though it's been hard sometimes to see it and believe it, I know that God, you were faithful every step of the way. And it was really a declaration song for me of the next season that I was entering into my life. And I ended up signing a record deal with Red Street Records in the fall of 2019, which is incredible. And entering into a season in a year like 2020, it's pretty wild. I never thought we would be there. And honestly, the past year and a half has been a blur, but I've seen God faithful in his hand in every single moment, every step of the way. And that's why I'm so happy that listeners are connecting with this song in the middle of a pandemic, because we all need a little bit of joy. We all need this truth in our lives. And I love hearing people sing this out as well.
Yeah, well, certainly it's such an uplifting song, full of energy. And yeah, you've just had an incredible 2020 year, despite the pandemic. Just chat to us how the year went for you, launching a solo career, especially during COVID-19. Just chat to us how it's all gone.
Absolutely. So at the beginning of 2020, I was actually out on a radio tour promoting my first debut single, which is a song called Provider. And I was on a radio tour. We had just finished up 25 stations that I had visited in February. We were about to go out on another radio tour in March to continue promoting that single. And I remember shows started getting canceled. And I was like, what is going on? This is crazy. And we were encountering this thing called COVID-19. And all of America and really the world shut down, right? And I remember going back home actually to visit my family and being with my family for a couple months and no shows, just really processing a lot of stuff and my faith and my life. And there was a moment in time where I just got on my knees and was like, Lord, I don't really understand this, but I'm going to trust you. And that was a key moment for me And there was kind of a shift that began to happen. And I saw that, okay, how can I use this moment in the middle of a pandemic to connect with fans in a new way? And I began to do a bunch of live streams where I was connecting with fans every single night for almost 6 months straight, every single night on social media, and was continuing to write songs. I actually finished up my record last year, which was a huge highlight of 2020. That record's coming out this year, and I'm super, super excited about that. And I was really able to plant a lot of roots here in Nashville, where I just moved and been here a year and a half, like I said, and just super thankful to see that even in the midst of craziness, right, we have a God who's faithful through all of it. And even though it's hard to see and believe sometimes, I know that's the truth, and that's the hope that we can live in today.
Amen to that. And then just in terms of lockdown, the pandemic, as you said, like reflecting, planning, is there kind of a scripture or a motto that you were really leaning into to support you in the last few months?
Absolutely. Proverbs 16:9 is actually a verse that goes really well with every step of the way that, man, the more I live life, I find that I'm not in control. As hard as that is sometimes as humans, we want to try to control things and hold everything in the weight of our hands. But Proverbs 16:9 says, the heart of a man plans his ways, but the Lord establishes his steps. And that's also just such a peace that we can rest in that, you know, we can plan and do. And it comes to a year like 2020, the Lord really ultimately establishes our steps.
Yeah, absolutely. And then in lockdown, when you weren't writing, when you weren't planning, what type of music have you been enjoying listening to?
That's a good question. I listen to a lot of different types of music. There's an artist named Ben Rector. I don't know if you've ever heard of him. He's big here in the States. Fantastic artist. I listen to a lot of Christian music all the time. Some artists that I've looked up to over the years, Phil Wickham, those are some big artists that I just love listening to that have really inspired me and my sound. And I'm always looking for the next fresh thing to inspire my music that I create.
Thank you so much for chatting to us today, and best of luck as well with the album launch. We'll look forward to featuring and covering that here in Ireland.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
That was Victoria Johnson there chatting to singer-songwriter Kate Thompson.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.